With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. State potato farmers boosted by ample water and higher prices. After a four-year decline in potato production nationwide, this season's crop appears poised to buck the trend, spurred by strong demand and improved water supplies. Higher processing contract prices are driving much of the increased acreage. California's mostly fresh market growers may see prices decline once harvest starts elsewhere. California's fall and spring fresh market potato crops typically enjoys prices 2 to 3 times those of Idaho russets because they fill specialty markets and hit the market window when other states aren't harvesting. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. State Attorneys General against the EATS Act. A coalition of 16 state attorneys general sent letters to the congressional leadership regarding the EATS Act. Sponsors of the Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression Act have positioned the bill as a regulatory solution that will undermine states' rights to regulate agriculture within their local jurisdictions and nullify numerous states and local laws that already exist. Those hundreds of laws that would be invalidated support family beef, dairy, egg, and pork producers, as well as hundreds of laws related to food safety and invasive pest control. The letter states, quote, "For over 200 years, state and local governments have been responsible for ensuring that there is a safe and healthy food supply for their consumers and that locally sold farm products are governed by locally accountable elected officials." Groups like the Organization for Competitive Markets and Competitive Markets Action say the act would upend the crucial balance between state and federal authority. NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's Brian Derman with back-to-back agriculture news.
Peach production in California was strong this year, with fairly minimal pest and disease pressures. Manager and field representative with the California Canning Peach Association, Sutton Hunter, said the off-grade was very minimal this year.
And I think that partially had to do with the lighter set, less peaches to take care of. They were bigger size. They had less disease and issues. The growers were very diligent in doing their sprays, I think partially because there was a lot of rain this year. And with a lot of rain on these types of crops, it can cause a lot of issues. So there was a lot of diligence out there in the field and taking care of the crop. Fewer peaches, better size, less disease. So on an off-grade perspective, it was a very successful year.
However, there were a few rejected loads due to worm infestation.
If it's over a percentage of worm, the canner has the right to reject that load. And a couple of loads happened that way, and our reasoning and thinking behind that and why it happened as I spoke with the growers is because the price of nuts are down so far right now that a lot of growers, small mom and pop farms, are not spraying because they're not going to make anything off of those nuts. And so the worm got heavier and the navel orange worm got heavier in the nut crops such as almonds and walnuts. And even if you sprayed in the peaches, there was enough to still work over and make a dent in the peach crops that were surrounded possibly by nut orchards. So that was one disadvantage, I would say, to some of the conditions this year that our growers just weren't expecting. And, you know, it's hard to see that coming.
The farm workforce has an important role to play in the advancement of agricultural equipment. Director of Mechanized Equipment Development for DiRigo Brothers of California, Andy Holt, said the skill sets of current farm employees are already well positioned to adapt to new and emerging ag tech equipment.
You know, one of the things you have to remind yourself of is when we're automating something, when we're trying to develop a robot, who do we think of first? We think of the worker, and then we try to emulate that worker. And then we realize we're not very good at doing what they do with our machines yet. So who do we go and ask? You know, the resident smart guys, we go ask the worker how they do it and what they are looking at. So I think you develop a pretty deep respect for the job and the work that they do, and you think about what people are capable of. You realize how hard it is to emulate a human when you have to, you know. So manual labor that we look at and see is still very skilled.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, a recent Farm Foundation online forum showed just how wide the gap is between Democrat and GOP farm bill priorities and how tough it may be to complete a farm bill this year. John Newton is chief economist for Senate Ag Committee Republicans.
Since the last farm bill, farm production expenses have increased by $114 billion. And it's every single category that farmers are paying. They're paying more for fertilizer, paying more for livestock feed, paying more for diesel fuel, paying more for labor, paying more for pesticides. Interest rates are going up at a rapid rate right now.
But reference prices are not keeping up with rising costs.
When you spend $1,500, $1,300 to raise a crop, and you know that the commodity prices have to fall by 30, 40, you know, in the case of chickpeas or oats or corn, over 40% before it triggers a Title I program payment, you realize that's not much of a safety net.
Chief Economist for Senate Ag Committee Democrats Stephen Wallander says nutrition and other farm revenue streams are his side's priorities.
So when you have that additional spending in SNAP benefits and other nutrition programs, right, those are creating tens of thousands of real jobs. An extra $1 billion of spending on SNAP creates over 500 jobs on the farm.
Newton says none of that will matter if farmers go broke.
In 2023, USDA's projection for net farm income and net cash income is going to be the largest decline that we've ever seen in history. In the case of net cash income, even when you adjust for inflation, we're looking at the largest decline that we've ever seen.
With a projected 30% plus decline in corn, nearly 30% in wheat, and more than 20% in soybeans, and a whopping 80% decline in dairy cash net income. Dr. Joe Outlaw with the Food and Ag Policy Center at Texas A&M University points out that farm bills have never been easy to pass.
We've done this, you know, 90 plus years, and they've never been easy. That's the one thing I really wanted to make sure everybody understands. The farm bills are hard to do because you've got people from both sides of the aisle, both sides of Congress, that have different priorities. And so this is kind of a melding of priorities. And over my career, in general, the Democrats have been really supportive of food programs and conservation programs, not that they don't support the other side, the Title I, the producer payments. But when you have, you tend to have different groups saying that they want to protect certain areas, like in general, over my 40-year career, basically, Republicans have been really focused on the safety net, Title I specifically.
And Outlaw reminds people farm bills are written for the bad times, not when times are good.
Obviously, prices are good. They have been good for a couple of years now. And so the safety net kind of went away. And that's the way, by design, we have a countercyclical safety net that when things go bad, the government steps in pretty significantly. When things are good, the government kind of takes a step back and lets the market function. And so that's a really, really important thing for people to remember is that all this safety net, Title I discussion, we can talk about conservation, we can talk about climate change, all those things within the context of the farm bill. But when you look at the safety net side, it's all about the bad times. And frankly, as a couple of people have alluded to, the bad times are coming. They're just not here right now. And so it really makes it, I've been quoted across the press quite a bit recently saying that this is a terrible time to do a farm bill. One, all the things going on in Washington, I don't want to reiterate that. But two, the conditions are good. And if you've done 8 farm bills like I have or been involved in them, you see that they're a little bit easier to get things moving when there's some sort of crisis in Washington. And there's not one right now in terms of the ag producers' perspective, their incomes.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, USDA announced that the August milk margin triggered the eighth consecutive payment for dairy producers who obtained the dairy margin coverage, or DMC, for 2023. That month, the income over feed margin was $6.46 per hundredweight, with projected DMC payments totaling $120 million. So to date, dairy producers have received more than $1.2 billion in much-needed economic support for 2023, and margin forecasts indicate the likelihood of more to come before the end of the calendar year. Of course, DMC is a voluntary risk management program administered by USDA's Farm Service Agency. It offers protection to dairy producers when the difference between the all milk price and the average feed price falls below a certain dollar amount selected by the producer. Now, DMC does complement other assistance available to dairy producers. That includes the Milk Loss Program, MLP, and the Organic Dairy Marketing Assistance Program, or ODMAP. MLP covers milk that was dumped or removed without compensation from the commercial milk market due to qualifying weather events and the consequences of those weather events that inhibited delivery or storage of milk. And then USDA recently announced a second round of payments for dairy producers through the ODMAP. It provides an additional $5 million to help dairy producers with marketing costs to mitigate market volatility, higher input and transportation costs, and unstable feed supply and prices that have created unique hardships in the organic dairy industry. To learn more about these FSA programs, simply contact your local USDA service center. And cattle producers have a new tool for their toolbox, something that was developed as a way to effectively and efficiently record calf data. Agnet Media's Will Jordan has more details.
There's a new calf data management tool from Kansas State University for producers to put in their toolbox. The free program called CalfDex, released earlier this month.
We designed what was meant to be a easy-to-use, easy-to-access, simple way to, in the field, record calf data associated with the cow. So the whole thing was that you could have your phone out there instead of a notebook that you're scribbling on. And when a calf is born, if you weigh it, if you do some processing of it right there, you right away go in, you find the cow, you put the tag in the calf, you identify which cow that calf went with, toggle whether it's a heifer or a steer. Like I say, if you actually are weighing it, great, the date's there already. And as soon as you've entered that, and if you've done any vaccination, then all of that's in there in your phone. And as soon as you get back to self-service again, you can store those data onto a cloud platform. Once you've got it populated with lots of animals or even just a few, you can ask it to send you a spreadsheet with the data on it as that calf goes through its production phase.
For Agnet Media, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will, and I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A new scholarship helps students while honoring a cattle icon. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The George Miller Memorial Scholarship is named after a man who was considered an icon within the Holstein breed and a generous leader in many other breed associations. Jeff Ziegler, Vice President of Dairy Cattle Breeding for Select Sires, says at Select, they work to remember their heritage and success stories.
George is one of those true success stories, not only for Select Sires, but the industry in whole.
Hosted by the Holstein Foundation and awarded by Holstein Association USA, the soon-to-be annual scholarship was brand new this year. Because the George Miller Memorial Scholarship was built to represent all he did for the industry, the chosen recipient needed to share the same passion for giving back. Kyle Conan, a junior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, was awarded the first ever $1,000 scholarship during the recent National Holstein Convention. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. Most farmers use the cash method of accounting. It's easy and usually advantageous to do so, but certain rules apply when a taxpayer changes accounting methods. Most farmers use the cash method of accounting, but when an accounting method is changed, certain rules must be carefully followed. A method change can result simply from not depreciating an asset to claiming depreciation. In a recent case, a farmland owner that leased out land changed from not claiming deductions for amortization or depreciation on the USDA base acres to claiming the deduction starting in 2009. That's a change in accounting method, and it requires IRS consent or the filing of Form 3115. That didn't happen, and when IRS audited, the landowner claimed there had been a change in business practices that justified the accounting change. The tax court said the landowner failed to prove it. It was simply a business decision to start claiming deductions for the base acres. Another problem was that the leases involved were cash leases. That meant the landowner wasn't entitled to any deductions associated with the rental activity anyway. Also, when an accounting method is changed, the IRS will make adjustments to prevent the duplication or omission of income or deductions and to reflect the cumulative difference between the old and new methods. In the case, the landowner's mistakes cost about $250,000. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
A judge's decision in an ag wage dispute. A federal judge denied a request to block a federal rule change related to farm worker wages. The judge's order denied USA Farm Labor and other plaintiffs' motions for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction. Alex Cracchiolo, head of marketing at USA Farm Labor, says the rule change will mean increasing costs of hundreds of thousands of dollars every year.
If you are hiring H-2A workers to do things like picking, probably you're going to be unaffected by it. But however, if you're planning on having workers come over and do things like harvesting your crops and then transporting them to a local elevator, if you're doing any sort of trucking over the road, especially if it requires a CDL, a lot of times those occupations would get flagged and assigned a significantly higher wage rate.
While the judge denied the request, he also rejected the Labor Department's motion to dismiss the case. Plaintiffs can proceed with a standard federal court timeline. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Building up edible and plant health protections on the African continent. That was the main theme involved in a series of announcements made by an Agriculture Department official participating in recent conferences in Africa. Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Jenny Moffitt made one such announcement during the Africa Food Systems Forum in Tanzania.
What we'll be doing for the Africa Phytosanitary Program is we're going to start with 11 countries this month. So there's 11 countries that will be part of the Africa Phytosanitary Program, but the goal is to include all 54 countries in Africa in this program by 2026.
The undersecretary says the Africa Phytosanitary Program includes financial and in-kind expertise from USDA APHIS to develop advanced, science-based approaches to plant pest and disease threats to participating African nations.
We work with the African Union on harmonization of standards across and within the African countries as well.
Another partnership announced during Undersecretary Moffitt's visit to Africa focused on improving animal health infrastructure on the continent.
Early warning systems, investing in IT technology.
Details on that particular partnership includes the following.
USDA announced an investment of $17 million in partnership with the World Organization for Animal Health. It's going to do work globally to build and strengthen partnerships as well as the infrastructure for folks to be able to insert into an IT system different major animal diseases, outbreaks that are happening so that we can control them and manage and mitigate transboundary animal diseases.
While the investments are on a global scale,
with Africa being such a large part of our agricultural system globally, they're going to certainly receive a large portion of that in projects.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Just two trading days into the fourth quarter, an analyst on Wall Street and LaSalle Street in Chicago already saying October could be worse than September for commodities and financials. I'm Mark Oppold with your Bottom Line Report brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Bottom Line financial analysts say the higher for longer interest rate forecast should be taken seriously. Congress did avert, of course, a government shutdown, but analysts add the U.S. is, quote, burning up its credit standing around the world, unquote. U.S. debt spiking toward $35 trillion, a number few can get their arms around. And regarding commodities, soybeans and wheat markets will be a pull on corn. Weekly update showing good progress, though. Corn should be the first to bounce back with another lower close, especially. This is the Bottom Line Report. December lean hogs looked oversold to start the week and we think can continue to rebound. October is pork month and pork specials should help. That's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So now it's starting to get a little bit warm. Now, I understand that it's still, you know, like 60 degrees, but the sun is really, really coming out. I really believe that, or maybe it's just me, but it has been really hot. I've been having to put my air condition on when I'm driving now. Now, I like to do something really, really cool when it starts getting warm, definitely during summer. But while it's getting warm, it's something I love to do, and that's to make fruit juice jelly. Now, what's so good about fruit juice jelly is, first of all, it's healthy for you because it's like drinking juice. But more importantly than that, it's a very simplified recipe that you can enjoy. You can make ahead of time so you don't ever have to worry about this. You know, it's good for about a week in the refrigerator, and that's always a good thing, especially for kids getting out of school. It's very, very simple. So all I'm doing is taking 2 cups of any organic fruit juice. Now, I love a really good fruit punch or a good watermelon. What I like to do is do equal parts fruit punch and watermelon. And I like to just mix them together. And I'm going to put those into a pot. Now, it's very, very important to remember this. When you're doing these kinds of recipes, you can't just like put this on and let it go. This happens really, really fast in terms of cooking what we're going to do here. All I'm going to do is put this into a pot and I'm going to bring it to a hard boil. Once it reaches that hard boil, I'm going to kill the heat completely and I'm going to add to this 1.5 tablespoons of agar gel, and I'm going to add to this as well 1/2 cup of sugar. Now, you don't have to put the sugar if you want this to be healthier. I totally respect and understand that. I like it to have a little bit of sweetness to it because I think it just makes it taste so much better. What I'm going to do now is bring it up again the heat, and this time using an immersion blender, I'm going to blend all of that agar gel into this mixture. Now, you really want to, you know, the agar is ready and it's awake and it's alive when the bubbles, they don't start going up no more, but they start to kind of bubble into themselves, and you start to just see this mixture no longer is super liquidy, but now it's got a thickness to it, and that's how you know it's done. And usually that takes about a good 2 minutes, but you really want to make sure the agar is blended in there. Then I'm going to put this into a pan and let this set in my refrigerator for no more than 4 hours before you can consume it. Then after that, you can leave it in there whenever you want. And it's almost like Jell-O, but the texture is completely different. The color is completely different. And I promise you, the flavor is completely different. For this and many more of my Untamed tips, tricks, and all things Untamed, go to www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You all know me as the Untamed Chef from AgNet West.
Well, I guess it's time to pull out the songs about fall again.
When an early autumn walks the land.
Okay, hold it right there. She's singing about an early autumn, but this year, in many areas, fall weather's been late. But just in the last few days, some places finally have experienced some actual cool fall-like weather. And of course, for many of us, fall means just raking the leaves. We are inspired, though, to do other work on the lawn in the springtime. But one expert says if you have cool season grasses like bluegrass or tall fescue, when fall comes,
that grass really breaks dormancy and takes off and starts growing. It's a great time to get in there and do some work.
Dennis Patton is a Kansas State University Extension Lawn and Garden expert, and he says fall is the preferred time to do three things that most of us try to do in the springtime.
Fertilization be one. Here again, the lawns are hungry after the long, hot, dry summer. Two would be if we've got some thin or dead spots, get in there and overseed or reseed the lawn. And the third practice that's really great done in the fall is something called core aeration, or aerating your lawn, which removes plugs of soil about the size of a finger out of the lawn that then helps repair the soil, loosens, breaks up the soil, also helps water nutrients move down into the soil for a healthy root.
Now today we focus on seeding or overseeding.
Seeding is an art and a science.
Mostly though a science. Patton says if you seed in the fall, you have a much better chance of getting a really good stand of grass, but not if you make a lot of mistakes.
I think the most common mistake people make is they don't properly prepare the soil.
Patton says do not just go out and throw out some seed on the ground and expect results. You have to first get that ground ready.
Make sure we get good seed soil contact. And that is usually done with a process called verticut or verticutting. And what this verticut does, it's a machine you can rent or hire someone to do, and it slices small grooves down into the soil that breaks through that soil crust in that thatch layer, and then it allows for that seed to fall down into those grooves. Then when we start watering, we get good seed soil contact, which in turn then lead to better germination.
So next we talk about watering, very important, not just a couple of times a week either.
Because our goal is to keep that upper inch or so of the soil moist at all times during the germination process, which is probably going to take a minimum of a week to 10 days to 2 weeks, depending on the type of seed and your soil condition.
Finally, Dennis Patton recommends what's called starter fertilizer, which has more phosphorus.
Because there is scientific research to back up that a little free phosphorus right around that germinating seed will help increase root development and growth.
So do a good seeding job now so your yard won't look seedy like mine does come springtime. And your newly planted grass will be much better able to handle the stress that'll come with the hot summer weather. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have the latest Farm Bureau's Farmside Chat.
Hello, I'm Zippy Duval. I'm president of American Farm Bureau and host of the Farmside Chat. Welcome back. And all of you know that I travel the country and get to talk to farmers and ranchers, doing all kinds of things that helps fill the pantries of Americans and a lot of pantries across the rest of the world. But this week, we're going to talk about someone that has experience in two different kinds of fields. One, field of growing crops, but also the football field, because we're knee-deep in the football season, and I know everybody's enjoying Friday night football with their high school, favorite high school team, and also Saturday, seeing our college players play, and some of you like pro football and spend it into Sunday, watch them. But this farmer is going to be fun to talk to. His name is Matt Kroll. He's from Iowa. He played football at Iowa for the Hawkeyes, and then went on to play at the New York Jets. So So welcome, Matt. We've been looking forward to having this conversation with you, but I'd like for you to start out by telling us a little bit about your experience on the field with the Iowa Hawkeyes and at the New York Jets.
Yeah. So I started playing about 2005, graduated high school in 2004, and then from 05 to 08, played defensive tackle for the University of Iowa. Like I mentioned, it's about 20 minutes from my farm, so it's kind of a natural fit for me to go play for the Hawks. And then after college, from 2009-2012, I played for the New York Jets, so part of their active squad, part of their practice squad. So it was kind of a cool experience to be out east and to be in New Jersey and New York and experience that culture.
You know, quite a different change in culture from the farm to New York City.
little different pace, Mr. Duvall. Yeah, it's still good people, but a different pace of life for sure.
You know, when I think of New York Jets, I think of Joe Namath. And, you know, when I was a kid, he was a hero to everybody, you know. And so New York
Jets. He was still around a lot of practices. So Broadway Joe was there quite a bit. So
really?
Yeah, it's interesting.
You got to meet him, man.
Yeah, no, he talked about every camp. You know, I was in four camps, so he was around the team quite a bit, and I don't think he's changed much since he played. He's still a pretty big personality.
I'm surprised, as bad as his knees was, he could even walk around after all those years. Yeah, that was some wonderful childhood memories of watching him. He was pretty neat to watch. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned on the field, in the field, whether it be on a football field or whether it be out in the field growing a crop. Tell us some of the lessons that you learned on the football field that you carried over into agriculture.
Sure. I mean, it's kind of cliche to say, but you get out of things what you put into them. And that's, you know, that's directly correlation between farming and football. I mean, football, you got lifting weights, you got film, you got studying your opponent. You got the whole winter program, summer program, getting ready for fall. And then, when it's time to execute, and whether that's be on the field or in the field, planting crop or taking care of that crop, you know, it just comes with preparing and being consistent was my biggest thing. With the Hawks, I started 50 straight games. So that's kind of what I carried into farming. It was just day-to-day basis, grinding and working and putting the time into to make the crops work and fight the battle against Mother Nature when she rears her head and do the best you can with what you can control.
So it sounds like persistence and determination. And, you know, that describes farming, that's for sure.
I think it represents, yeah, a majority of the farmers, you know, definitely. I guess, you know, things are going to go your way and you adapt, overcome, and hopefully succeed at the end of the year.
Yeah, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, we watch y'all play on Saturday, on Sunday, and nobody really thinks about the time and effort you put into it before you get there. And I'm sure when somebody's chowing down on a good hamburger or eating some beautiful for vegetables, they don't really think about all the toll that goes into the work of growing that crop either. So there are a lot of similarities to it.
Sure. Yeah. And I probably didn't think about that too, Mr. Duvall, when I was shoving food in my face, trying to weigh 315 pounds and play D-line and O-line for the Jets. And, you know, things that we take for granted when, you know, I was just playing a game for a living, you know, one of those deals, and all the food you could eat in college too. And, you know, you a lot of people do it, and even farmers do it at times. You know, there's all types of farmers, and sometimes we take for granted of, you know, how blessed we are to grow the food that people eat.
So that's a good lead into my next question. When you were playing ball, whether it be college or pro, how many of those guys had any interest in that food and knowing that you came from a farm? Were there many questions about it?
There were some stereotypical, hey, Matt, where are you from? Yeah, from Iowa. They're like, oh, are you a farmer? I'm like, well, yeah, I came from a farm. Yeah. And they just, you know, that was Mark Sanchez. So he was a Cali boy. He was our first round draft pick for the Jets that year that I came to them, you know, and he didn't mean anything by it. You know, he was just kind of going off what he knew or learned of Midwesterners. So yeah, you got some glimpses, or gave them some glimpses into your upbringing. And, you know, that was the beauty of of sharing a locker room too was the amount of different backgrounds and culture that was in a locker room of 53 guys in pro and then 120 guys in college that came from all different backgrounds, all different areas of the state. So yeah, it was interesting. And some guys latched on, and I brought some guys out here and experienced, showed them what a diversified farm in Eastern Iowa would look like.
Yeah. It's amazing how people really are interested in where their food comes from. Making a difference how old they are or where they're from, they're always interested in that. So is there a moment in your football career that you feel really defined who you are?
I think I kind of mentioned it. I was blessed not to get injured and not to get hurt and be productive enough on the field that I could start 50 straight games. So I started every game that was available to play for 4 years. So came in as I redshirted, and then freshman through senior year played every game at D tackle. So I think that, hopefully that's testament to, like we talked about, just putting in the work and showing up every day and being on time, going to class and producing on Saturdays. So if one thing that, exemplified my career was just consistency and hard work.
And I would think a lot of young men that play at that level, both of those levels, had that same hard work. But I would think coming from a farm, it probably came more natural to you than it did to most. I remember my son was in the military and he was flying Black Hawks over in Iraq. His superior wrote me and said, man, if I had a whole group of farm boys like your son, said we could get in and out of here right quick. It was pretty amazing. He recognized that about him.
I always thought in camp, you got your football helmet on, you got 20, 25 pounds of gear, but there's really nothing harder than bale and straw or square bale and hay when it's 110 degrees with 100, percent humidity. So, those times where you're working or working cattle or doing whatever you do on your place, when you're playing football, you're just playing a game, and there's really nothing harder than working on the farm some days.
That's right. I wish I was as young as you are. Even though it was hard work, I look back at it, it was some of the best times of my life, when I could get out there and hang with the best of them. And I can still hang with you for about 10 minutes.
That's what people ask, hey, can you still play? I'm like, no, I can give you 3 seconds of one play probably, and I'll still feel it tomorrow. But, it's a different world. Did you grow up in Georgia then, Mr. Duval?
I did. Okay, I grew up here in Georgia on a dairy farm.
Gotcha.
And not many people know this, but I walked on to try to play football at First Presbyterian, and I made it for 4 hours in the tryout. That was about all.
Perfect. You gave it a go.
Oh, it was fun. The coach said if he was handing out scholarships for guts, I'd be first in line. So,
hey, I'll take that.
This was just a portion of their conversation. To listen to the full episode, visit fb.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. More than $3.5 million awarded to Climate Smart Agricultural Programs. The California Department of Food and Agriculture's Environmental Farming and Innovation Office is awarding $3.7 million to fund 24 programs across the state. CDFA has a goal of ensuring that programs who support producers that apply for any of the Climate Smart programs are accessible for all farmers, including those that have been historically underserved by CDFA grant program in the past. The funds will help the organization with technical assistance. CDFA Secretary Karen Ross says, quote, "This is absolutely essential work as we adapt to a changing climate. These grants build upon our previous investments in technical assistance and help us attain our goal of reaching every farmer and every acre in California with encouragement and support for at least one Climate Smart practice. To view a list of the awarded organizations, you can visit the Climate Smart Agricultural Technical Assistance website at www.cdfa.ca.gov/OEFI/technical.
Registration is open for the International Research Conference on Wang Long Bing, which returns to Riverside next year. The conference is being produced by the California Citrus Research Board with the support of California's citrus industry partners under the advice and guidance of a joint conference organizing committee. It's going to be held at the Riverside Convention Center, March 26th through the 29th, 2024. Early bird registration for the conference will be available through December 31st. The meeting will bring together researchers from around the world to share the latest information in the fight against HLB. The event kicks off with a welcome reception on the evening of March 26th and will be followed by 2.5 days of breakout sessions, keynote speakers, and poster sessions. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.